Hi, it's Henry Shelford, CEO and co-founder of ADHD UK, here for our next deep dive, which is rejection sensitivity dysphoria. And I'm thrilled to have Dr. Shai Mashru, psychiatrist here. Hello.
Hi, Henry. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. And you?
Yeah, no. Well, thanks for having me again. I think we've got quite an interesting topic, which is going to resonate with many, many people here who either have diagnosed or undiagnosed ADHD. This topic, when I bring it up in consultations with patients who've come for an assessment, they often break down in tears with this one, actually.
Okay, well, try not to make me cry. And rejection sensitivity dysphoria, what is it?
Okay, so in a nutshell, it is described as a complex and intense, and underline the word intense here, emotional response that occurs when someone feels a perceived or a real rejection or criticism. The driving force behind this is an intense fear of failure or rejection. And this is seen in almost all patients with ADHD. It was a term that was originally coined by Dr. Paul Wender in the 1960s. And at that time, Dr. Wender was looking actually at children with diagnoses of what would be now ADHD. It wasn't called ADHD at that time. And what he was noticing was the intense emotional dysregulation, which we've discussed in a previous episode, actually, of these children who would be looked at as potentially overly sensitive children who were having lots of tantrums. And then there was more research done by a chap who's still around now, actually, who talks about this subject, called Dr. William Dodson. The interesting element of rejection sensitive dysphoria, was lots of interesting elements, but one of the big ones for us as clinicians is that this is it's not even called a symptom. It's an experience that's seen in almost all patients with ADHD. In 1/3 of those patients, Dr. Dodson's data shows it's, and I would agree with this actually, in my own experience, I've probably seen 6,000 odd patients. It's the most crippling experience in ADHD in at least 1/3 of patients. And yet it is not part of the current diagnostic criterion in ADHD for ADHD. And as the talk progresses, it can look like other conditions. And this might be one of the reasons where ADHD is missed for other conditions.
So what's it looking like? Like, what are you? Well, pull back slightly. So intense fear of a rejection. How's that different from
response
when I was in dating, being rejected at the?
So good question, Henry. I mean, essentially, it is all a matter of degree with rejection sensitive dysphoria. So dysphoria comes from the Greek word, which means unbearable pain or suffering, okay? So no one likes to be rejected or criticized, right? No one really likes to, you know, fail at things, right? That's not an enjoyable experience by anyone. But RSD, rejection sensitive dysphoria, is much more than that universal discomfort of rejection and failure. Patients will describe this almost as a physical pain. And it can destroy them for quite a long period of time. It comes on all of a sudden. That's how it's described. They can't control it at all. And it's instantaneous. Many patients can actually describe themselves feeling things like chest pain, breathlessness. It's physical almost. They find that they can't control it. They find this hard to describe until I describe it to them a lot of the time. And that it must run its course it's very hard for them to control this until they start to understand what this is. And it can last anything from minutes to months in duration. And it has then sort of, I would categorize it as two types of effects. If it's internalized, it can look like major depression, complete with suicidal ideation. And I've seen that in some patients. If it's externalized, it can present as rage directed at the person or situation that they have deemed as wounding them. And that can cause a lot of breakdowns in relationships, work relationships, personal relationships, etc. So it's the intensity of that response.
You talked about lasting for months. How's that, and it being confused with depression, how is it different from depression?
Okay. So let's talk about the different conditions it gets confused for, first of all, right? Because there are a few.
Well, if we're doing that, I want to throw in anxiety as well, because like when you talked about the feeling of chest pain, it felt, that sounded a lot like a, my understanding of panic attack. So yeah. Okay, back to you.
So there's a number of different conditions I've seen this get potentially misdiagnosed for or look like. One, generalized anxiety disorder with panic attacks. I would say the key difference here between RSD and that is in the name. So generalized anxiety disorder is when a person is in a general state of anxiety and what's called catastrophic thinking all the time. They always are jumping to the worst scenario continuously. So there's a constant state of anxiety all the time, not necessarily in response to a particular situation. RSD, when you talk to the patient about RSD, they'll often exactly be able to pinpoint, it was when my partner said this, that triggered me. Or it was when this happened, when my boss was going to call me in for a chat, that triggered me. And I started worrying about losing my job. I'm going to get found out. So there's often a trigger. Where else can it get confused for? Social anxiety. People, just think of this logically. If you have an intense fear of failure or rejection, you might, as a protective response, actually start to avoid or withdraw yourself from social situations where you know you need to meet new people. So I've had patients tell me, it was really embarrassing because I started this new job. It was a Christmas party. I had to make an excuse not to go. Because they are worried about being judged or even found out. So they might avoid social situations. They'll go and talk to their, potentially, you know, their family doctor about this. That can look a lot like social phobia. Third one is something known as borderline personality disorder. Or emotionally unstable personality disorder. So if you remember, I said, if RSD responses get externalized, it looks like rage at the person that caused them that wound. So what starts to happen? They can start lashing out at their partners, for example, lashing out at children, lashing out at work colleagues. If you have a person who's presenting on the outset as being potentially difficult and breaking down their relationships, sabotaging their relationships, that can look like borderline personality disorder. Next type, depression with suicidal ideation. I've had patients who told me that even in their teenage years, they might have had a first love and that relationship ended from the other party's side. And I've had a patients who have actually attempted overdoses in response to that. On the outset, and then they were very low in their mood, naturally, as well, afterwards. That can look like major depressive episode with suicidal attempt. And then another one that it gets misdiagnosed with is bipolar disorder. If in the day your emotions are basically going up and down in relation to situations, so you are experiencing your high highs and your low lows in response to situations all the time, if you go and talk to someone who might not have knowledge of this, you could get diagnosed with bipolar disorder. The key difference there, though, with the bipolar disorder, which I think we might have touched on this in a previous talk, is that with bipolar disorder, you will have clear time periods of low mood and hypomania. You might have weeks or months of depression, and then several weeks of a manic episode. And the other big difference, again, and this is often the difference with all of them, is that in RSD, there is a clear trigger that the patient will be able to tell you about. Whereas in the other mood disorders, it's not very clear to them why they are feeling that way.
I think that, you know, I think it's an important takeaway. So the difference is that you've got this clear trigger, this clear rejection that's then driving all those other aspects. And so what do you do then? Like, how do you help deal with this?
I think before we go into that, even, Henry, what I want to answer,
jumping ahead,
if you don't mind, is why might people develop rejection-sensitive dysphoria? Why does this happen? Do you know why?
The third for whom it's the most crippling experience.
Why do people with undiagnosed or, you know, untreated ADHD, why do they start to develop this mentality in their life?
I'm pretty sure people don't want to hear from me. I'm pretty sure we need to hear from you. So you tell us.
Okay. So the underlying core belief or hot thought in psychological terms here is the feeling of I am not good enough. Now, if you've gone through your life and no one knew you had ADHD, including yourself, you have gone through many elements of your life essentially struggling. So you've gone through an education system where you probably felt that you might have not ever met your academic potential. Teachers might have, you know, said that you're lazy. You might have started thinking you're lazy because your parents were telling you that you're lazy. You would have gone to a work environment where you felt that you were having to work so much harder than your peers, working after hours, etc., just to keep up. You might have not been getting the promotions like your colleagues did, who might have not even, in your view, worked as hard as you. If you have had RSD at work, you'd have avoided the social interactions and not got into the right crowds to maybe move up a corporate ladder, for example. You might have been looked at as slightly odd or difficult, even at school as well, so not made great friends or persisting friends. You might have had your partner essentially over time. I'm not generalizing here. Obviously, everyone's situation is different. I'm just giving caricature stories that I hear across people's lifespan. But your partner feeling that they're carrying you in their marriage, that you're not pulling your weight. You might feel like a letdown to your children because you're snapping at them. You're getting very irritable with them, and then you feel terrible afterwards. Over time, if you can pardon my French, you're going to feel, well, I won't say it, but you're going to feel terrible about yourself. And you're going to start questioning your own self-worth and value. Over time, that starts crippling your self-esteem. If you have low self-esteem, then how do you perceive yourself in society? I am not good enough. If you think that you're not good enough, you will naturally start developing fears of failing at things, of being found out, some people say. You will fear criticism because you will fear that you are being found out. You'll get terrified when you get that potentially completely benign email from your boss saying, can we have a chat after work today? Just want to run over a couple of things with you. You'll get terrified over time that your partner might want to leave you because you're not keeping up your end of the marriage or the partnership or whatever it is. So naturally, over time, you are going to fear failure and rejection. Now, if we look at Dr. William Dodson, who's a bit of the godfather really in this field, he actually says that this is purely neurological or biological process. In my view, there is probably that going on, but I just think if you think of the natural life course of a patient with undiagnosed ADHD, it's not surprising that they end up thinking and feeling this way about themselves. And that's why I think this happens in so many people.
Honestly, you aren't like, we had an agreement that you had not to make me cry. it's quite hard to hear. You said Mr. Dodson says there's a neurological aspect.
Yeah. So then we can talk about treatment now, I guess, in terms of that neurological aspect. Currently, in terms of medication, in the UK, this is definitely not licensed. I'm putting this out there. In the US, and I think in Canada as well, they are finding some evidence for certain types of medication called alpha agonists, which might help with RSD. And I've actually tried this in some of my private practice patients. So we're talking about medications like guanfacine or clonidine. Now, these medications, interestingly, were originally designed to lower blood pressure. And over time, with research, they've started seeing that they can be quite effective in ADHD. And people who do well with these medications will describe feeling a protective armor around them. So what that means is they will still feel an emotional response as anyone would do to a failure or a rejection, but it will feel more tempered and toned down with that medication. This is not for everyone, and it's certainly not, it's not backed by enough research for it to be licensed in this way in the NHS. But there is some evidence for that type of medication, and we're not exactly sure why that's happening in terms of the chemistry, but we are seeing that to a level. The second form of treatment, which I think is actually where you should go to first with this type of experience, is actually talking therapy. So when I say talking therapy, what I mean is, and we touched on this in the emotional dysregulation talk, is breaking down that experience and introducing a pause. Emotional responses are fast and very strong in ADHD, as well as RSD. Comes on very fast. The trouble is, people struggle with ADHD with regulation. That's every type of regulation. So emotional regulation, attention regulation. In adults especially, ADHD is not really a deficit of attention. That's the wrong name for this condition. It doesn't describe it properly. It's a dysregulation of attention. You have too many competing thoughts going on. It's not that you're brain dead.
We tend to say it's different, where it's just a lack of control of attention.
Lack of control, right? So in the same way, there's a lack of control of that emotional response. So with a good therapist, you want to learn to introduce, to almost step away from yourself in that moment. You know, this is used in mindfulness techniques. Buddhists have used this for thousands of years.
I hate mindfulness with an absolute passion, although I do realize some people like it. It does sound huge, though, like, because you're talking about the, you know, that lack of control into the reaction and then going, you know what you need? Control. Like,
it's not about you need control. You need to be able to step away and observe. That will bring control in itself. You can't control. It's not about control. It's about internally saying, hang on, can I just take a time out for a minute? And then almost having someone come in there and imagine in your own mind now this is all going on to tell you, Henry.
Really don't need to imagine, but yeah.
but Henry, look, can we put this in context? Okay, what's happened here? Is it the worst thing in the world? Can we remedy this? Do you think they really meant that? Is that how they always talk to you? Rationalization questions, right? That is a practice. And I think, personally, that is far more effective than just taking some meds to try and curb this. Because this is going to be with you forever. And then more than that, is to actually start working on self-esteem.
Yeah, I think, and that might actually be a very good, completely separate video. And it'd be interesting to do. I think one of the important takeaways that, because I can feel it in my head going, man, like, you know, that jump to have that stepping to one side, it feeling very impossible. And I think one of the lessons you're communicating is that it is very possible, that you've seen many people do it and the benefit from getting that. And but good talking therapy is going to get that for you, which is, I think if they don't quite believe it, people need to believe the process.
I think also it's about building awareness, right? For example, a good coach, and you know, you'll know more than I do perhaps on this as well, but a good coach for RSD should start to build awareness in that person of what situations have triggered my RSD responses in the past, and really get specific on those details. Because you're going to start seeing certain patterns and themes emerging. Different situations, they're actually maybe falling into two or three themes. Also, other things a good coach will do is to make someone become more aware of, well, does any other features make you more susceptible? So, for example, patients will say, you know, when I read certain social media posts, that triggers my RSD. Feedback. I've given talks to employers about how better to give feedback, actually, in general to staff, whether they have ADHD or they don't have ADHD. Because 9 times out of 10, it's not all bad. When you've got an employee, they were good enough to take on. It's not, probably not all bad. And actually, when you look into it a bit further, you'll realize the intention of that person is, they don't mean to make XYZ error, right? So it's about developing understanding. I've done that work with employers as well. And to make employers, for example, aware of, well, how damaging your feedback can be if someone's got RSD, especially.
On that point, okay, because we've seen it where you've got an individual who's like, I've got ADHD, I've got RSD, and essentially shut off the ability to get feedback, and they've made it so difficult. And it's ruinous, because then you don't have the feedback loop. You don't have the, like to succeed here, I need to do this. And it can cause a really big problem between that person and their boss. How do you avoid that and then deal with that when you see that happening?
So this is, I think, a good area, again, where a good coach can work with the person. So understandably, that member of staff.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point, because what you're saying quite clearly, you've jumped straight to, look, this is actually something the individual needs to work on. Yeah. You need, as part of working, to be able to receive feedback, and otherwise you're not going to get better. You're locked where you are, and if you're locked with big problems, then you're locked with big problems. If you're locked at that position, then you're locked at that position, but you can't grow. And so then conquering that as an individual is what's needed. And it's not, although the manager can get some advice, it's primarily within the individual, which is quite a tough lesson to hear.
Yeah, and but I think it's about giving them the skills. So, for example, one thing alone, when you make someone aware about RSD, initially, it's a very strong, it's saddening. I've really seen people break down in clinic about this one. But then over time, so I'll see them a month later, maybe for a follow-up. They'll have read a lot about RSD and other people's experiences. They'll have reflected a lot about, okay, this makes sense now. I understand where this has come from. Hard pill to swallow, but once you've swallowed it, actually, knowledge starts developing into awareness.
And then that knowledge that your reaction isn't normal, right? Like that's...
But not just that your reaction isn't normal, because then you can start almost judging your reaction. It's more about, I understand why I react this way now as an adult. I get it. Where is it come from? And they track back into their own lives, right? This is with a good therapist, I think this is the kind of work that's done.
Yeah. And I think some of the things we were talking to earlier are definitely more into the counselor territory than the coach, but it does, it really, yeah. Obviously.
But where is it
individual?
Yeah. So where is it coming from, right? We spoke about, I think, before trauma, right?
Yeah, although we should always touch on, because people will be watching these individually as well as all of them. So if you've got a point, I'd...
Yeah, so I think the point is, right, that you're going through lots of little traumas throughout your life and you don't understand why they're happening. That's even worse it's not even worse. That's not the right wording. When you go through, if you go through a form of traumatic abuse, you understand that there was a perpetrator and I'm the victim. If you go through life with these mini traumas and you don't understand who the perpetrator is and I'm not the victim, but why am I feeling this way about myself all the time? That's very hard. It's a very hard narrative to get your head round, right? So a good therapist should start to unpick that with the person, I think, and make them understand this is why you respond now the way you do, because you've had all these mini traumatic events and not really understood what is going on. Why am I feeling like this? Why do I behave like this? And yeah, no, I can understand why my partner's getting angry at me. I'd get angry at me. Who wants to be with me? That needs to be unpicked first. Then you start doing strength-based training, working on the self-esteem. People with ADHD in employment can actually have wonderful skills that other people don't have. They often work really great under pressure situations where everyone else is collapsing. They can be really dynamic. When they enjoy something, they can be more passionate than anyone else in that department. So working on strengths-based training. Maybe they'll work, encourage them to work better in environments where they are, where their strengths are, yeah, as well. Over time, that improves self-esteem. So the awareness of where I am, why I am the way I am, and now where do I go from here? That is an important part of this. And to me, that is a harder piece of work. It's a harder piece of work than taking medications. But you're changing fundamentally something internally about how you view yourself in the world. And I think there's nothing that can beat that.
Clearly critical. And we talk about most medication being a helping hand, and it's a helping hand to get you over that hump to understand yourself better and put those strategies in place and support you. This is such a hard topic. It's you mentioned earlier that it should be part of, that it's not part of the diagnostic criteria. when I hear that, it makes me feel like it's a automatically included part of ADHD. So you, how would you include it? Because I think your view is that it is being discussed as a potential to be incorporated. So could you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah. I think there is, so right now, right, in the DSM diagnostic, right, even with ICD-11, so the you know, the UK model and the, you know, the international American model, we are still, even in adulthood, really looking at ADHD like we would in a child. So those diagnostic criterions were based on fields of research, based on children, number one. Number two, they were based on boys, young boys with potential ADHD symptoms. And that's why so many women and girls have been missed. That's a secondary feature of the diagnostic criterion. Number three, because rejection-sensitive dysphoria is so hard for patients to describe, it has been very hard to measure this in research. And when things are hard to measure in research, they are not counted as a valid thing. And that's where it's hard in terms of quantitative research. If you look at qualitative research, where you're asking people's opinions and their experiences, you will have bags of examples of this occurring in nearly all ADHD patients, in adulthood especially. In childhood, you have it as well. They just don't know how to describe it. They get diagnosed with things like oppositional defiance disorder when they're not listening and they're having tantrums and meltdowns. That is likely to be elements of RSD in a child who doesn't know how to verbalize that feeling. So I'm certain that in the next DSM criterion, because this gets brought up a lot in conferences, I'm certain in the next DSM criterion that not only attention symptoms, hyperactive impulsive symptoms will be part of it, but the third category is going to be all the emotional element of ADHD. And that is critical. And the reason why that is critical is for two reasons. Number one, everyone's talking about, oh, everyone's got ADHD nowadays. Everyone's got ADHD. It's a fad, blah, blah, blah. I actually, and many other clinicians, will argue that this is a condition that has been misdiagnosed for other conditions. I give lots of talks to GPs. And I tell them, audit all your patients that have been diagnosed with treatment-resistant depression, treatment-resistant anxiety. People who have been on multiple antidepressants, they haven't really worked, they're revolving door patients, they keep coming back to your clinic. Many of those patients that then come to me and my colleagues and get put on stimulant medication, for example, and start to understand their emotional symptoms better, start seeing a coach, etc., they get better. And often I will have patients tell me, Dr. Shai, I don't care now anymore that I can focus better. I'm a little bit less fidgety. I feel emotionally better. And that's the most significant impact of treatment for me. Forget everything else. So until it's part of the diagnostic criterion and described properly, it's going to get missed. It's going to get misdiagnosed. And then you might end up on completely the wrong treatment. Mood stabilizers, which can have horrendous side effects. You could be completely being treated incorrectly. I want to put a caveat here, which I've done, I think, in the past. Antidepressants, mood stabilizers, etc., have their place and they can be very effective. But it's not if you're treating the wrong thing. So I think that's why it's important for it to be in the diagnostic criterion.
And you talked earlier also, and that's so it's in the diagnostic criteria as an indicator of ADHD, and to so that people can see this and recognize rejection sensitivity. You've talked about mood, and you also talked about rage, which we've not touched on. How do you treat rejection, a rage which has its source in rejection sensitivity? Is it the same, or are there differences?
It's the externalization of that, right? So depending on someone's personality type, perhaps if they've always been a more introverted person, they will experience that rage inwards. And rage experienced inwards is depression and self-loathing. Rage experienced outward is having massive blowouts and arguments, for example, typically with loved ones. You see that a lot. Feeling insulted very quickly. All of that is because of underlying low self-esteem. And it comes back to working on, how did I get to this place? Why am I the way that I am? So let's stop punishing myself, self-loathing, etc. Now work on how to go on from here. It's all about your internal world and how you see yourself and all those little traumas that you went through and didn't. And there was no clear perpetrator. You're not even a clear victim. It's about untangling that.
For our next one, should we do ADHD and low self-esteem and what to do about low self-esteem? It feels...
We can have a think about it. We'll have a think about it. We'll have a think about that, yeah. But I think that's very... This topic of RSD, I guess the important points are, this is universal. I see this in nearly everyone, almost everyone. And Dr. Dodson says it's about a third of cases, it's their most crippling symptom. I think it could be higher, actually, in my patient caseload. And actually, if you tackle this, it's almost... I think this is the one where people feel like this was life-changing.
It's a big unlocker.
More than focus. This is the one that... It's the very essence of that person.
Wow. And I think that's the good part to sort of finish on and to leave on, is the positivity of recognizing what rejection sensitivity is, how it's impacting you, and then how you can change that and change that positively, how enabling that knowledge is and that work can be. And that's the important thing, not to languish in how tough it is, because it is, because I've found this entire session quite hard. And I think to break out of that and go, you know, this is an area where substantive, and that's, I think, what you were just talking to, substantive change can happen that can really, really have a positive impact.
Yeah, absolutely. The biggest, I think.
I think that's us wrapped on this topic. Unless there's anything else you want to add, or has got the...
No, I think we've got the critical parts of it.
I thought that was, absolutely fascinating. Thank you. And pretty tough listen, but in a positive way. Shai, thank you as ever. Thank you for doing this. Look forward to doing the next one. And I think they're brilliant. Thank you for sharing your expertise. Thank you for having that expertise. It's always good to have a quick shout out on how you can see Shai. So Shai works both in the NHS privately. So if you're lucky to get him in the NHS lottery, you're very lucky. And if you want to go privately,
If you want to see me privately, you can see me in person. My clinic is in central London. You can book through my website, which is www.adhdhealthclinic.co.uk.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much. Thank you, Shai. Thank you. And that's our wrap for this one. This is obviously part of our regular deep dive series. Keep an eye out for announcements on the next, and we'll be going through, and I'm going to be I look forward to the next one. Thank you for joining.